listeners. I can't believe he'd go off and insult half of his listeners like that. What was he thinking?
Please tell me that's what this guy sounds like.
Yes, he does.
No, he doesn't. There are people, and it's funny because like, I was about to be like, oh, that's not Oklahoma, but there's actually a person in the store today who does sound like that, so I can't make that argument.
Like, even somebody saying something smart in that voice sounds dumb. It's like, I can't believe you all think that you're gonna give up a main deck slot, take out all his dust and replace it with Ugin. You fucking kidding me right now? You really think you're going to get an appreciable difference in your land distribution by running one fetch land and cracking it just for a shuffle? Are you serious? If you run the math, it's only a 0.4% difference in your probability of getting a land. Listen to this guy over here.
Oh, my God. Now, that rant came from our resident comedian, Jason E. Alt. Man, Jason, come back to the stage.
What's he doing insulting half of his listener place like that? Half the people who listen to this podcast have this exact voice. And think that the woman who was shot to death by her 2-year-old Walmart today is a triumph for small government. That's half your listeners.
Sweet fuck.
Corbin, so Corbin, yes. is this how it is in Oklahoma? Tell us, is it really?
You know, for the purposes of fulfilling everyone's stereotype, yes, that's exactly how it is.
I mean, you just said there was a guy in your shop today that sounded like that.
There are some people, yeah.
Marcel, stop doing your "this is the podcast" voice.
This is the podcast.
Yeah, this is the podcast. That's what I'm
saying. It's definitely the podcast.
You're not going to do that.
Oh, we are. It's been done.
Good, and some of that was not usable.
Oh, it was hilarious. It's all usable.
I see how you're trying to cover yourself.
That's exactly what happened last time.
You're trying to cover yourself, Jason, but he always uses it. Every time with no Marcel, this isn't the podcast. It's always the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
And then you arguing with him on whether or not it makes the podcast is actually the podcast too.
Yep. You should just accept it, you know. Just take it.
Honestly, I stand by everything I said, and I stand by the voice I used to say it. Oh, there I go again, insulting half our listeners.
God damn it.
So this is Brainstorm Brewery. Episode number 129.
My episode numbers on the show notes are always right.
Yes. Welcome everyone to the most special of episodes, where we can't get all of our shit together.
It is the last episode of 2014, which really? Won't really
No, it's
be
actually the first episode of 2015.
Yeah, exactly. So happy new year.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess so. Time travel's
funny.
Oh, man,
that's lame. But... we could have last week made a big deal about being the last episode of 2014. We fucked up.
It's, yeah.
Well, that's just how this cast is. We are just, you know, a major letdown. Yeah. We're a show of the potential of what we could be one day.
Our listeners we'll know there. How my wife feels all the time.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Oh, so you're packing four. I see.
Why are you thinking about his wife, Corbin? That's messed up, man. Don't think about another man's wife like that.
That's okay. Corbin's not a threat to me.
I mean, you're not wrong, so.
So the day the podcast comes out is the 2nd of January, and I will be in Denver at GP Denver for the weekend, hopefully to get some standard in, so that should be fun.
Are you actually going to play in the main
standard
event?
Well, I thought I was going to get a deck because I don't have any standard cards, and so I sent
Surely
a tweet out.
Somebody can hook you up.
Well, so yeah, someone said they were going to hook me up, and I was like, all right, here's a deck list, and then I found out that they weren't going to be at Denver, and then they were going to ship me the cards, but, you know, I didn't want to take that
yeah.
risk and stuff.
That's
like,
a little different.
Yeah. So
you,
I was like,
you know, if you show up, though, somebody will just hand you a deck.
I hope so. I hope someone got Abzan, because I've been jamming some Abzan control of the
McLaren.
Whatever, who cares?
We say Abzan just because you're gonna say Abzan.
Yeah.
Well, every time we do it, our listeners learn the proper name.
I actually got to beat Paul Chion on his stream, so you get to see some of that good Abzan action. Hey, I gotta work my way to the top.
You know, Marcel should tell you something about how impressed our listeners are gonna be if your podcast co-host, whose job it is to be impressed by your exploits, aren't impressed.
I know, so it's the little victories, you know, you gotta build upon the defeats of the small stuff.
What were you playing that you beat him in?
It was a daily.
Oh, you're playing standard?
Yeah, playing standard.
I thought it was gonna be Holiday Cube or something fun.
Oh, well, I wanted to jam some standard. There's enough Holiday Cubes. It's like, I don't know, this one's not as fun as the other ones. For some reason. I can't.
But you can you can vault key, right? Isn't that in it?
Yeah, which is really bad. Actually, it's bad for the format.
It does sound kind of dumb to have it in the format.
But. Oh, but cubing actually, I got to do a sanctioned cubed event actually. When with TSG, I went down to Santa Cruz. I cannot think of the game store. This is so bad.
way to give them that shout out, Marcel. They were so great. I don't even remember the name.
I went to this place and it was, oh man.
It's on the tip of my tongue and I cannot think of it. I'll probably think of it by the end of the cast. But,
we'll put it in the show notes if he ever remembers.
But it was we got to do a rotisserie draft with this cube. So we had 10 players, got a sanctioned event because of the new, the way that they're able to sanction any kind of wacky format. And I came in third, actually. I went 3-1. So
explain, I actually imagine a lot of people don't know what rotisserie draft is. How does it work?
So rotisserie draft, you basically take the whole cube and you put it all on the table. Face up, everyone gets a look at it, and it's all sorted out by colors, so it's all in order. And then everyone gets their pick order. And basically you go like a snake, so first person picks one card, and they can pick any card they want out of all the cards that's in the draft. The next person goes down until you get to the 10th person, and then the 10th person gets to pick two picks, and then it snakes back down to the other person until it goes to number one, and number one gets to pick two picks. Until everyone got the 45-card deck, basically.
So rotisserie draft is famous for taking hours.
It took about an hour for the 10 people. We kind of – it wasn't that bad, actually. It was a little more than an hour, but it was pretty fun. I never did it before. I was actually a little intimidated jumping into it. I was like, what to do? And
Weren't some of the original Pro Tours rotisserie?
Yes, they had some. That was definitely part of the format. And I think
rotisserie draft was the best to watch.
Oh yeah, I could totally see it. I like it.
It just took forever for coverage. No, it wasn't that bad. It took a while, cause the way they did it was like team rotisserie too at times. So like that was like took a while cause you'd like convey to other people like, you know, what you want to draft. And that's how they did all their team formats for a while, if I remember correctly.
Oh yeah, I can imagine team rotisserie just being a talk fest. All right, go for this and go for that.
I think I did a rotisserie draft of Pokemon cards one time.
Pokemon.
It's the only experience I have with the format.
Well, it's cool. It's just a different way to consume Magic, and you know, I like that. You got all these different flavors you can go about it, and Cube allows you to get down with that. So this is more of a reason to invest in Cube. A lot of people has hit me up on Twitter saying, "Hey, I got into Cube because of what you've been talking about, Marcel." So shout out, keep the Cube alive. The Cube's the best format in Magic. Everyone's going to come.
I really thought when Corbin like completely destroyed all the momentum, that would be a good place to segue, and you completely ignored that perfect opportunity.
I'm not going to stop. See, the problem is you guys like to not let me talk, because when I talk, I could go all day long.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I gave him a window to talk about Cube. Sorry, guys. That was my fault. I accept full responsibility.
But you know what I really want to put into my Cube, though? A lot of these new cards from the spoiler. Fate Reforged, baby. Man, it's looking good.
Now that's a segue. I tweeted that there are more exciting cards in like the first 10 cards in this set spoiled than in all of Cons. And just to show what nerds all of my Twitter followers are, they're all like, no, the fetch lands were real exciting. So way to miss the goddamn point.
The fetch lands are really exciting this time around too.
We're not talking, yeah, they're exciting here too. We're not talking about like the excitement of reprints and that kind of crap. Like, this isn't Modern Masters. This is a set where they're giving us brand new cards and they're all super exciting. And I've been doing the spoil coverage on QuietSpeculation.com and it has been a lot of fun. I'm really enjoying everything I get to do over there. And I think my article with a spoiler on Gathering Magic will have gone live by now. So, that was cool. That's my first spoiler.
Yeah.
I can't tell you.
You can't. You can say the name of the card, and we won't know, so we can know what the spoiler is when we see it. You know.
Well, if the article has not gone live by the time this cast goes out.
Oh, I see. Well, press embargo. I got you.
Good try though, Marcel. It was a good attempt to get him to slip. No, the cards from this set are cool, this set are cool, and I'm sure we'll get to all of them in a little bit. But before we get there, we want to talk kind of on a finance 101 part of the cast, how you handle spoilers financially. You know, I guess so. Let's start, like, if you see something really cool like Ugin spoiled, and you're like, oh gosh, that's a card I want to play with. I mean, let's assume that we've talked it in the past, because I know we have, that pre-order prices typically go down. But what tips would you guys have for someone who, say, does want to buy an Ugin to play with? I mean, what do you order as soon as it comes out in case the pre-sale price goes up? Do you wait until the day the set comes out and get it, or what? What are your guys' tips there?
I mean, it very much depends on how quickly you want to play with that Ugin. If you're a person who's patient and you're only going to play EDH once a month with your buddies, then just wait. Like, wait, it's going to be cheaper once the supply hits in about 2 to 3 months after set release. That's your time to get in. If you are a person with not as much patience and you are looking to, you know, just get a hold of the cards while you can, and you are playing EDH twice a week with your friends and you really want that Ugin for your deck, just go ahead and buy it, because your pre-release prices are rarely that much different than what they are right at release, and it usually takes at least a couple of weeks to a couple of months for those prices to adjust and settle, because you have to get that, you have to see what the actual supply is going to make up for the demand before those prices are ever going to drop retail. So until that happens, you're really just wasting your time. If you're going to buy the card before you wait a couple of months, buy it immediately, I guess is the better way to say that.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. In the amount of money you'll save, even on a Planeswalker that is subject to the Jace tax, which means that Planeswalkers are always going to be really expensive. And recently Nissa was like the only one that hasn't gone down. So the amount it goes down sometimes isn't even worth waiting. You know, if you consider you paid 10 cents rent a week, or 10 cents rent a day to have the card early. Like, it's like, what is your enjoyment worth to you also? So, if your financial interest in Ugin is the one copy for your EDH deck, I don't think I'd worry as much.
Okay. So, I mean, let's talk about actually getting cards. I mean, what's the best way to do it? Should you be buying boxes of the new set to try to, you know, just get a bunch of the cards so you have them? Should you be buying complete sets where there's like one of every card in the set, or play sets of the set, or should you just, you know, buy kind of the flashy stuff?
I mean, that very much again comes down to how much and how often you're going to play and how many cards you want from the set. You know, say you're a big fan of dragons and you're a dragon collector, then maybe you should go buy some boxes, because there's going to be a lot of dragons in the set. If the set itself does not interest you enough to where you think that you're going to want a multitude of cards from it, then don't buy boxes from it, because unless you're going to turn around and make money off of all that extra stuff and take the time and effort into immediately getting rid of it at pre-sale prices, it's not worth your time.
Yeah. Okay. So one of the things I've, for the competitive players, or, you know, people out there who play standard, one of the things I've seen some people locally do that I've, you know, they've given good reviews on is buying a complete play set of the commons and uncommons. Once you remove the rares and the mythics, it's actually very cheap, and there's a bunch of websites that will sell you just the commons and the uncommons for a good price, and you can get – that way you don't have to be busting packs, and you're not scrambling around looking for, you know, your random uncommon that you need. And I think that's really a good way for those people who play – want to play, you know, at FNM or whatever, to actually be in a good spot the day the set drops. You have many fewer cards to track down that way.
And sometimes it's a really good deal. I paid something like $26 for a playset of commons and uncommons for New Phyrexia, like pre-ordered super early, and I actually got sent it, which was weird because like by that time people were paying $5 a piece on
Mental Misstep,
yeah. So that was a good deal. So sometimes it really works out, but yeah, I mean that's a good way to just not have to track that stuff down. But on the other side of the coin, to an extent, give yourself a chance to open stuff in packs also. You know, like, before you play the events, you know, where the set's legal, you're gonna have a few stabs at pre-releases, and I would play as many pre-releases events as you can for sets that you like.
And I would give myself a chance to open some stuff in booster packs, you know, and to trade at the pre-release. Because that's where I pick up a lot of the stuff that I really feel good about is trading at the pre-release. So that's it's a fine way to get cards. And, you know, there is upside to those events because you're not just paying for the cards. You also have a non-zero chance of winning some prizes and getting a lot more packs that way. So there are a lot of ways to get cards in, especially those first few weeks. And, you know, maybe play some Magic too. I know we're all finance people, but I think we all play the pre-release.
Yeah, pre-release. That's like my one time I can justify and not feel bad about playing Magic.
Yeah, I mean, the pre-release for this one's definitely going to be a lot of fun. It looks to me like limited play for the new set will work well enough with cons that, you know, cons was everyone saying the best draft format since Innistrad, and some people place it above Innistrad. This seems like it's going to be a nice addition to that.
Yup.
Yeah, like, we didn't say anything because, like, yeah, we super agree with you. It's going to be really exciting.
Right. So there's one thing you said, Jason, I want to touch on before we go farther. You mentioned the Jace effect, and, you know, we take it for granted because we all know what it means. But do you want to explain for the people at home exactly what you mean when you refer to the Jace effect?
The Jace effect, or the Jace tax, is a tendency for everyone who pre-sells Planeswalkers to not take any risks and any chance that they're going to undersell the Planeswalker. Jace the Mind Sculptor, which ended up being like, I think, $100 at its peak when it was standard legal, was a card that pre-sold for $20. I bought 4 Jace the Mind Sculptor pre-sale for $80. That seemed fine to me.
And it just kept going up throughout the entire life of its pre-sale.
So, even though every Planeswalker isn't Jace, and it's very, very likely that no Planeswalker ever again will ever be Jace, that doesn't matter, because no one is going to take the risk of underselling a Planeswalker. Planeswalkers are going to sell out at their pre-sale price pretty much no matter what that pre-sale price is, you know, within reason, because they appeal to everybody. They have good ability, so competitive players like them. Collectors like them because they're like, oh, I need one of every Planeswalker. Casual players like Planeswalkers because they're just flashy and cool, and they're really iconic. Casual players love Planeswalkers, so they appeal so broadly that you can justify charging more money for Planeswalkers. And since there's a possibility that the Planeswalker could be the next Jace the Mind Sculptor, no one's going to ever make the mistake of undercharging. So there's like a little bit of a bump. We call it a tax. You know, the price is a little higher than it might be ordinarily just because of the Jace effect, I guess.
And it helps that they're always mythic as well. So they're like automatically going to be priced at the top tier.
Yeah. I mean, even Tibble sold for like more than $5.
Yeah.
Which was probably a mistake.
All right. So we got an email here. I want to knock this one out because it goes along with the first spoiler we had from the new set regarding lands. But this email is from Scott H. He says, guys, with the shortening of standard to 18 months, Wizards will have to keep making usable dual lands. How do you think this will affect lands as a long-term investment? So what I take from this question is, as you guys probably know, the rotation cycle will be moving to every 18 months instead of every you will have a rotation more often. Things will only be legal for 18 months rather than for 2 years. So I guess they have to print more lands more often to simply fill that void. What do you guys think this does to your shock lands or your M15 pain lands sort of thing?
I think they've expressed a willingness to do reprints, and there's enough cycles throughout history that they can go a really long time without ever having to do anything new if they don't really want to. I think there's a possibility that they'll print something better than a Shockland or a Fetchland in the future, but I think that's relatively remote given how perfect the Shockland is. Like, I think the Shocklands are the perfect lands in terms of standard, in terms of how balanced they are. And they probably won't do those outside of Ravnica set, and they probably won't go back to Ravnica for like another decade. So I think those are relatively safe, but I just don't think they're going to print anything better than that. So I think they're relatively safe long term. I think they would probably reprint a cycle, or maybe they had a whole bunch of cycles that they hinted at in Future Sight, and they could do any number of those. Like the Grover the Burn Willow cycle could be a thing, or the Nimbus Maze cycle could be a thing, or the what was the black
Riv,
blue one? I really
black,
liked that one. No, the red-black one was Grave and Cairns, and that was fine. The black-blue one.
River Tears, that was
a very good one. Because people really liked that, like, if you played that turn one, you could tap for duress, or you could hold up, like, a force spike. So it just seemed like the perfect black-blue land. That could be a cycle, too, so I'm really excited.
I really hope they get aggressive with reprints of dual lands, and that we don't get these lands that are great speculation targets, and that we get enough reprints that they stay at a reasonable enough price and they get in the hands of players, because I mean, it's been proven we need to have dual lands for an active market, for an active format, and I think just having a premium on that is not necessarily a great thing for just, you know, Magic in general, and people need to get dual lands in their hands, and they need to, you know, get their collections, and they need to be able to brush off their collections when it becomes off and rotates into standard. So I hope that they constantly just stay on the grind and keep reprinting duels more aggressively.
Well, I think to, you know, kind of answer the question, it makes things like your filter lands, I think those are probably the best ones that aren't just like immediately super competitively played, even though they are a little. It's like those have been great long-term investments if you picked them up. The Scars of Mirrodin ones are another that people are kind of on the train of. I think that you just have to factor in that reprint risk. I don't think it damages stuff like that for the long term, because it's not every land is going to be the shock land or the fetch land that they're just injecting massive amounts into the market. I think that when those cycles come out, they're fine long term, you know, at least like 5 years outlook. I think they're still going to be pretty good speculation targets, because I don't think that they're going to constantly re-up themselves on lands. I think you'll see really, you know, continue some tame dual land cycles, kind of like, you know, not necessarily the Gates or Tranquil Cove cycle, but just along that power level more so than necessarily the Fetchland Shockland power level. That leads into the other announcement that we had from Fae Reforged, that the Fetchlands will be reprinted in Fae Reforged along with the game lifelands, just like they did with the Shocklands in Dragon's Maze, which obviously means we're going to get a lot more fetches. What do you guys, what's your take on this?
Good.
It's wonderful. This is what they needed to do to keep the fetches at a decent reprint.
And I think it's really predictable what's going to happen, because when they announced that the Shocklands were going to be back in Dragon's Maze packs, Shocklands fell about 30% across the board. I think we could see something similar with the fetches, which I think is just fine. Anybody who was like, oh, well, I bought a bunch of fetch lands thinking they were at their bottom and be a good long-term investment. Like, did you not remember what's already happened? Like,
well, it's
Wizards
not like
had never given
either.
Any, no, Wizards had never given any indication they were going to do this, but they never gave any indication they weren't either. And like, it just seemed, I don't know, nobody's surprised.
I think people certainly moved too early on it, because
we said January, February, so if anyone did buy in earlier, then you guys didn't wait enough.
Yeah, they weren't listening to us anyway.
And I mean, we were very clear. I mean, they're still, like, even if they weren't going to be in Fae Reforged, we're still going to be opening two packs of cons for three more months. Like, there's still plenty more fetch lands to come. So Jason, I know you've talked a little bit about the 30%, because that's what Shocklands dropped. Fae Reforged will not only be drafted once, like Dragon's Maze was, it will actually be drafted again once we get to Dragons of Tarkir. So do you think they're going to drop even further than that? Are we going to see, you know, $7 fetch lands dropping 50% here?
I don't know, because the fetch lands have a little bit more applicability than the Shocklands did, because the Shocklands aren't really played in Legacy. So I don't know if the cross-format applicabilities could be enough to prop them up. But, I mean, Cons is selling really well. It's going to be a good draft format. And Dragon's Maze drafts got stepped on by Modern Masters coming out, because people were drafting, you know, one pack of Dragon's Maze, and then Modern Masters came out, and once all those boxes were gone, it was time for Core Set.
Yep.
So Dragon's Maze really got stepped on, and, like, no one was buying those packs. My LGS couldn't give Dragon's Maze packs away.
But we're going to have the same thing with Dragons of Tarkir. That's going to come out of the Modern Masters, too.
That's going to make whatever's in that set really interesting, especially if, unlike Dragon's Maze, there's actually multiple good cards in it.
Which I expect. Some game changes.
Absolutely. I expect a bunch of... It seems like the set where even the casual Mythic Dragon will be $5 in a couple years because it's going to be, you know, butted up against Modern Masters.
Yeah, so I don't know if – I think the fetch lands are a little bit better than the shocks, so they might not fall more than 30%. And I think playability is going to matter too because I don't think a fetch land that's in a lot of decks and a fetch land that it's in no decks are both going to experience the same dip. I think demand is going to matter as much as the fact that we're getting reinjected supply. So I think long-term, that supply is going to attenuate their long-term growth rate. I think they can probably still hit the same ceiling. I think it'll just take longer.
I think that it's also very nice for limited, right? Because, I mean, this is the super multicolor format, and now we have more ability to play multicolor. I also think that I think that there's a price memory. It's not necessarily all about the supplier. It's also about what people believe a card will be worth, right? And a lot of people just don't believe that their fetch lands should be, they just won't part with a fetch land for under $10 because it's a fetch land, you know? That's literally a lot of people's reasoning. Like maybe you see like Bloodstained Mire go below that, maybe Wooded Foothills. I don't know that the others can just realistically sustain under $10.
Well, how do people get fetch lands, right? They'll open them in packs. They'll trade for them from the people that open them in packs. But other than that, you got your stores. And maybe Star City doesn't really care about selling like a $7 Wooded Foothills, but I don't think people are going to be enthusiastic. You know, if you traded for a Wooded Foothills at 8, are you going to throw it up on TCG Player at 7 just to sell it? Or are you going to sit on it and hope it goes up long term?
Exactly.
So I don't think people are going to be like fire selling these. So that makes me think that, like, I think you know, the price memory could be a real thing. Because if no one's really enthusiastic about selling them at a low price, then they really have to maintain a higher price.
I mean, and honestly, like, and we've seen lots of movement. Flooded Strand, thanks to probably the Blue-White Heroic deck, has gone up over the last month, like $3, $4. Like, long-term, maybe this dampens their ceiling a little bit, but I'm also excited just to simply have a chance to get more of them. You know, I honestly don't care what price they're at. When we hit either peak supply or rotation of standard, whatever, I'm picking up every single fetch land I can.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
I mean, it doesn't, like, they're reprinting them so hard here, just like they did with Shocklands. It's unlikely we're going to see them for a few more years, you know. Pick up a bunch of $10 fetch lands, and I still feel confident that in 3 years they're going to be 20, 25. And it's not, you know, while that percentage gain is good, over a couple-year period, it's not astounding in terms of magic since we see lots of 50% jumps overnight, stuff like that. But it's just so safe and predictable, and it's always going to be in demand that, you know, long-term, this doesn't dilute my optimism on fetch lands at all.
It's a good bear stock to sit on and watch it grow steadily. So let's talk about some exciting shit. I'm tired of being all this magic finance on blah, 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 boo.
Spoilers.
Spoilers. I don't want to hear nothing else. So, Jason, it's your Mr. EDH. And we got, on Christmas Day, we got this Ugin, this 8-drop Ugin. I want to hear your impression about it.
It'll be pretty good in a few EDH decks.
By that, like, do you mean everyone?
No, I don't know. I don't think this does what every EDH deck wants. I think Mono Black decks will really like this. Especially because you can get this out a little early with the Cabal Coffers. That Pernicious Deed's real cool. It does some things colorlessly that some colors are bad at, but I just don't know if it's what every deck wants. I'm interested to see, cause I read a lot of EDH player forums and nobody whose opinion I respect is really bullish on this yet. So I don't know if people just haven't like proxied up and jammed with it, or if it's just something that's like a few decks are going to run, but not everyone's super excited about. I don't know, man. It's a Planeswalker. Planeswalkers are pretty good in EDH, but I don't know if this is like $50 in a few years like Karn good.
Well, I think there's, yeah, I mean, that's obviously the comparison is Karn, and Karn went up a lot in part to its role in Modern.
Yeah, absolutely. Cause Modern, you can play more than one copy in a deck.
I mean, that said, Karn was $10. 3 years ago, like 2012, that card was, it was $10. I feel like if Ugin is anywhere near that, you pick them up because I do think that whether it sees any play in Modern or not, once it hits its bottom, it's a great pickup because it's just never going to not fit. It can go in any EDH deck. It can go in anybody's deck at home. It could see some competitive play. It's just, I feel like I missed the boat a little with Karn because it's like I knew this would be good and I knew it would be a good long-term one, but then I didn't have more than a couple.
Yeah, but it can go in any EDH deck and will or should go in any EDH deck are different things.
It's like, it's splashy, man. It does everything.
Sandstone Deadfall. Like, okay, Batterskull's a good card, and that can go in any EDH deck because it's colorless, not every EDH deck wants to run Batterskull.
No, Batterskull's not fun, though. Like, Batterskull is not a planeswalker.
I think any deck that's running Karn right now is going to run, you know, consider Ugin. But not every EDH deck runs Karn, and I think that's what a lot of people are forgetting.
I think a lot of decks don't run Karn because he's $50. I think a lot of decks would pick up an Ugin at 15 to 20, and we can pick them up at probably 8 to 10 on rotation. That's where I'm excited.
Price is not an object for EDH when you look at stuff like Metamox and sites like that that track just what people are playing.
Especially
if they're assembling their deck lists online.
There's a lot of people in my store who have looked at the Karn in the case and said, I'd love that for my commander deck, but I can't have justified paying $50 for it.
So what do you think,
it's 100%
Ryan?
A thing.
What do you think, Ryan? You got something to say?
Man, they're talking about EDH. I don't care.
Do you want to run Ugin in your Trostani deck, Ryan?
No, I didn't think so.
I think
not a bit. I don't want to run Ugin
Ryan's
in
opinion,
anything.
Ryan's opinion about commander is now something that means something, Jason?
Just more than yours.
I think.
Oh, I see.
Damn.
Jeez. No, like, I want to talk about exciting cards in the set that haven't been talked about since 2 months ago. Or whenever Ugin was spoiled. I don't know. I feel like that's all people talked about.
Four days ago.
No, it was more than that. It was a week ago.
It was Christmas.
I think Ugin could probably see standard play in Absin and Control. They played like Doomblast.
Oh, stop it. No, we're done talking about this card. Who cares?
It might.
Hey, man, I think Ugin's sweet and good.
It doesn't
Ugin.
Matter.
Yes.
Its pre-release price is not correct.
Yes, that's correct.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, we're doing that already?
What's
this? $24.
It's not even the $25. It's not even
$25.
Yeah, that's not a $25 card. No.
Let us be excited. Don't make us talk finance yet.
All right, Ryan.
Let's talk about a different card then.
All right.
Go, Ryan. You got first dibs.
Man, you can't jump me on like that.
All right, well, let me talk about this card.
Right.
This card is crap.
Ryan's ready now. Everyone's talking
about Temporal Trespass. They're like, oh, we got a Delve Time Warp. Oh, my God. It costs 8 and 3 blue, so it's 11 casting costs, and you got Delve, and you can take an extra turn after this one.
It's a 3 casting cost. Let's be real.
Yeah, so at 3, but it's 3 blue, so
yeah,
that's like – it's almost like 2 blue and 2 colorless. So it's almost like a 4 casting cost, you know, Time Warp, which is just one less than the actual Time Warp, which is such a setup. I don't think this card – we've seen the power of Delve.
It's 2 less.
We completely missed.
It's effectively one less, he's saying.
Yeah, because it's three colored blue, which makes it a lot harder.
I understand. Okay.
Instead of two, it makes it, so it's a little harder to cast than just a straight 5. So,
right, sure.
And we've seen the power of Delve. We completely were not right about, you know, Dig Through Time, except for Ryan. And, you know, we didn't see the power of Treasure Cruise. Now that we've seen the power of these Delve spells, everyone's like, oh, Delve, this is nuts. But this, I think, it's just so restrictive of a casting cost that you're not going to see this.
I actually agree. Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's like I got to thinking about it. First, I was like, okay, well, we've seen in Modern getting a bunch of cards in your graveyard. It's not a big deal. That's not hard. But yeah, the 3 blue, like at some point, the extra work really isn't like worth it. I agree.
It basically precludes 3 colors. And Soul Tie is the best way to enable this, usually. So it all but precludes being run in a Soul Tie deck.
But you play it in your Chase deck.
I mean, like, it probably gets played in that all the turns deck in Modern or whatever, but like, I don't think this is, you know, on the level of Treasure Cruise and
I think it's just another Time Warp.
Yeah.
And like, EDH players are saying, oh, this could be a format staple. I think it's just another Time Warp.
So let's talk about Ryan's favorite card that he likes. The one that this combo's good with the Chromanic Core.
Oh, that's not my favorite card. No, that was actually like more of a troll. So like, as much as I love Chromanticore and I want to make five color a thing, until I see a mana base for it, like I can't. Like it's not real.
You run it in mono black. We've run five color cards in mono black historically.
Stop this. I'm not talking about your janky decks. I'm talking about playing real standard here. And Soul Flayer, cute card, great with Chromanticore. Would love to run this guy in standard. Hope it's playable at some point.
It's not.
So if we're talking about like real cards that I like out of this set, well, I haven't been super impressed yet by anything. Valorous Stance, the uncommon. That's probably the most exciting card for Blue White Heroic so far.
You this haven't checked. Really you good. Know how I know you haven't checked the spoiler?
Why?
You haven't seen the new one, the Grandmaster?
Because
he's terrible. You don't play him in Blue White Heroic.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Card's pretty awful. Good though.
Not Blue White Heroic. Card.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about
the lifelink does nothing. Paying four mana, like I'll ever recur my spells.
Standard
no thanks.
Consists of the one deck that Ryan's managed to write 11 articles about.
Oh my
I've
god.
Written Blue White Heroic. Thank you.
You've written about it a lot.
Well, so for everyone else out there that's not playing Blue White Heroic piece of shit crap deck.
Well, sure. No, you asked me what cards I was interested in. You can't shit on me like that.
We just did. That's fine.
All right, I'm done.
So
you
for anybody, anybody at home, like we're talking about Soulfire Grandmaster. It's a bear, right? It's a white bear, except it's a mythic and has lifelink, and it has a line of text we've never seen before. Instant and sorcery spells you control have a lifelink, and for two colorless, and then two blue red hybrid. The next time you cast an instant or sorcery from your hand this turn, put that card into your hand instead of your graveyard. So.
As it resolves.
So if it resolves, it goes back to your hand, rather than your graveyard.
What if it's time warp?
Then sure. It's a lot of turns for 9 mana. Yeah, I mean 9 mana and take all the turns with those two cards. The instant and sorcery spells you control have lifelink bits. Pretty cool.
That's cool. Yeah, I will see how useful it is.
Anything that's new, that's like never been done before is gonna interest people.
That's why it's mythic.
I mean, you could play this in the tokens deck, the Jeskai tokens, or the burn, like blue white, red white burn. We'll see how that's going to replace, Master
Seeker of the Way. It's Seeker of the Way. I do think that this could be better, honestly.
In certain decks, I don't know if it's all of them, because Seeker of the Way, the way that it buffs is, it creates, more of attacking force than this will. This is always going to be a 2-2, and if you want to go to the long game, for it to really, you know, start to grind out and get all those advantage out of these cheap casting
costs. It's also really easy to kill, and as shitty as the whole dies to removal argument is, it dies to every removal.
Well, the question is we're comparing it to like Seeker of the Way, so it's like, it's the same base stats, right? So,
yeah,
in a lot of ways it's similar, and I mean, that deck plays a lot of burn, and a lot of those matches do come down to like, who can lifelink the most and get out of range of the other person's burn spells / Hordling Outburst tokens range, you know, like, yeah, so like giving all of your lightning strikes. Yeah. Lightning strikes, stoke the flames. Lifelink is pretty good. The issue being that this doesn't trade. It has basically no way to trade with a Seeker of the Way if your opponent has mana open.
Yeah. And it doesn't help your casting spells that do create tokens, but they don't get no lifelink. So you don't get no bonus off of that.
Well, that's right.
I mean, maybe, I don't know. I mean, the car is very powerful though. Don't get it wrong, but it's again, like, I think it could potentially be the same problem that Brimaz had when Born of the Gods came out. It just didn't quite fit in. It's a very powerful card, but didn't fit into a deck correctly at that moment, so it didn't really see much play. Later on, we did see Brimaz get adopted, and I think this card has a power level that at some point within standard, it will be adopted. We gotta see more cards and...
Well, it can create, in a lot of the matchups in standard right now, 6 mana basically creates a lock. Like when you start looping the lightning strike in your hand with this thing.
Oh yeah.
Like that just handles, like you can see your Obzon or some of the decks with huge creatures, it doesn't necessarily do a lot, but like that, like this card, a lightning strike and 6 mana is basically like living the dream against any of the token decks. So.
Yeah. Any fair deck is going to really struggle to beat this advantage. So it's fragile, but it's really powerful and, I'm excited about it. What price do you like this at, or do we not want to do that today?
No.
I've given it no thought. Like right now I'm just enjoying spoilers.
Yeah.
Cause I mean, I never really, like very rarely obviously are pre-sale prices worth even caring about cause you just assume that they're always too much. Especially with this little spoiled.
Yeah. I was going to say, I like the sieges. So like these cards are really, like this is something they haven't really done before either outside of casual. Like we saw this with the, what was it, War and Peace.
Yes.
It was an angel that did that. I think those are sweet though. Like that is, as a commander, if I have to be a commander player, I guess, as a commander player, like that's the kind of stuff that I think is cool and innovative. So I'm excited to see where that mechanic kind of goes. Like, I don't know if any of them are going to be great. The black one's far more intriguing than the first one they spoiled, but I still am not sure it's, you know,
black one could be, black one could be EDH player.
Yeah. The black one is
Palace. Black one is nuts in EDH.
Three black enchantment, obviously. Whenever it enters the battlefield, you choose cons or dragons. If you choose cons, you are going to Gravedigger every turn during your upkeep. And if you choose dragons, you are drain lifing for two each turn.
Every opponent.
And Gravedigger.
Oh, it's every opponent?
Yeah, each opponent.
You're returning a creature from your graveyard to your hand. So, oh wow, I didn't realize that was each opponent. Yeah, that's even better.
This card seems very, very good in EDH. Yeah. Man, we talk so much about EDH these days, but like this card's just good.
Cause you know what? Cause I think that EDH is a real blind spot for a lot of finance people. Cause it's just something they don't really understand, so I think having knowledge of that format,
that's fair.
Why is good in EDH? Cause it says each opponent. So yeah. That's scales. Well, and
the cons ability is good too. If you are, you know, in a recursion deck, like, you probably choose dragons most of the time, but you could choose cons as well.
I think in like an Ads and Mirror, this is like a game breaker. You just said that to cons and like all the removal no longer.
Well, there's like Erebos type decks that really like to build a prison out of black enchantments. And I think this is...
Marcel, you're talking standard, right?
Yeah, for standard. I think maybe the sideboard. I mean, think about it. For five, you could just bring back...
When you use the S word, like, it has no financial applicability just about.
Oh, no applicability. I just think that there's potentially this could be a C sideboard in Azen because it's such a grindy card. Azen, their matches are all about the grind. It's all about the card advantage, and they only have, to answer this is Utter at its end. And other than that, they have no other cards that can effectively deal with this. So if you have this on the field.
I can see that.
It's a trade-off.
That two damage life drain a turn is going to really help when they whip a Siege Rhino at you.
But that's like not what the matchup's about. Like,
yeah, it's trading cards. You trade removal for their removal for planeswalkers, and it's a removal fest.
You would definitely choose cons.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know, maybe.
I don't know.
I mean, the red one too.
They do have enchantment removal in the sideboard, Marcel, because everyone has to answer whip these days.
They got Utter's End. They only play Utter's End.
I love that you say Utter's End.
Yeah, like it's a cow.
It is the Utter's End.
What do you guys think about, like, using Palace Siege as an example, all of the modal cards where you pick one or the other? Like, we saw Crux of Fate very early. Hooded Assassin's a cool one. Like, what do you guys think of this mechanic?
You essentially get two cards for one slot in your deck.
Yep. It's like a better implementation of split cards.
I really like it. I mean, again, it's another memory thing that you got to deal with. Again, like, that was Soul Flare, and I'm kind of concerned with all the memory stuff you got, especially with the new cards that you got, the Manifest cards.
The complexity in this set is fairly high.
Yeah, there's a lot of
it's a lot of text, man. Yeah.
Yeah, this would not be a new player set for sure.
This is a lot of text on every single card that isn't common.
All right, so here's a question. I keep seeing all these people talking about how Shamanic Revelation is really good. Is this card as bad as I think it is?
It's worse than you think it is. I think it's worse than Harmonize. In most situations.
Well, like, the card says draw a card for each creature you control, and there's no, like, oh, you're automatically going to draw X cards, so don't worry. Like, you could actually just get fucked by this card.
Yeah.
It's a win more.
Like, it is a complete win more.
Oh, if I have 5/4/4s out, I'm going to gain 20 life and draw 5 cards. Yeah, okay, but what help do you need at that point? This card's not going to bail you out if you're behind.
The only card in this, like, vein I've ever liked was Momentous Fall.
And Momentous Fall was a bulk rare. Like, when Momentous Fall was printed, everyone's like, oh, thank God, this is an uncounterable way for me to remove my own Abyssal Persecutor.
Well, also, it was like in a set, it was in standard with Vengevine, and if it's a bulk rare when it's in a block with Vengevine, and it was played, then it's just gonna, like, this one has no chance. This is a sorcery.
Yeah. It's like, this is better than Collective Unconscious in EDH, which is good news for everyone that was playing Collective Unconscious in their EDH deck, which was like nobody. So everyone's like, oh, Shamanic Revelation's going to be great in my Prosh deck with all those tokens. I'm like, yeah, but take out the Collective Unconscious you're running now. Oh, you're not running it? Okay, then. Great. So Shamanic Revelation is just really bad.
I'll tell you what is good, though, is this Manifest. So let's talk about these cards. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have to.
I really think that the Silverwood Elemental.
Whisperwood Elemental.
Silverwood's funnier.
Yeah, but.
Okay.
Whisperwood Elemental, I think it's actually has the potential to be one of the underpriced cards. This might be worth pre-ordering.
It's at $9 right now, right?
Don't like that.
Yeah,
nine?
Yes, it's $9 on SCG.
Wow, I really didn't expect that. I expected this
card is pretty good.
Yeah, it is. So what this card is 3 and 2 green for a 4/4 creature elemental. At the beginning of your end step, manifest the top card of your library. What is this manifest you speak of? This is another way to confuse all the new players that are playing Magic, and this is another way for people to be able to cheat. Honestly, that was a preface. But so manifest is you put it, you put the top card of your library face down. It is a 2/2 creature. It is a manifest creature. It's not a morph creature. Even though it's face down, they got different overlays. So there's going to be manifest ones and there's going to be morph overlays. So you got to distinguish between the two because, if you reveal a land as a manifest, you're not going to get a game loss. Unlike if it's a morph and reveal a land, then you will get a game loss. And some people might try to pull some shenanigans. But if the card is a creature, you may turn it face up for its casting cost, or if it has morph, you may turn it face up for its morph cost. So this is a good way to create some card advantage. You're getting creatures out of there every turn. You get a 2/2. It could be a land that you're flipping over. It's going to create an army. And
well, it's the second ability that's real busted, right?
Yeah, and it has a second ability. So sacrifice Whisperwood Elemental until end of turn. Face up non-token creatures you control gain. When this creature dies, manifest the top card of your library. So this is a good anti-wrath card. So you can have your army there, sacrifice this as a way to protect all your creatures from wrath and flood the board. You could protect it for removal. There's different things you could do. You could just do an awesome trade and then pop this guy and just come back from with a lot more creatures. So there's a lot of potential in this. This guy's high upside, and we'll be seeing standard play at some place.
So now here's the question now that we're on to it. What do you guys think of manifests in general? You alluded to it, Marcel. It's complicated, right?
I think it's a judge nightmare. Like, I mean, I like that they're separating it from morph. I didn't know that before, but I still just feel like, the judges I've seen talking about it are like, you know what, we don't mind it, it'll be fine. So, which is not the reaction I expect from the judge community, which is like, you know, where's the, like, closest place I can hang myself, like.
Some of the things that come about is, well, most people when they play do not use the morph overlays, there's not always enough in a draft. You just put the cards face down, and it usually works. Now you're going to have to keep your face down morphs separate from your face down manifest cards.
Yes,
indeed. You really don't have to.
What if you slip it around and you say you manifest something? What if you morph a land and you didn't say nothing about it, and then you had a couple manifests, and all of a sudden you switched around one of the manifests that was a morph with the one
when
that's a land.
To block or something, yeah. Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, right. All of a sudden you morphed a land. And that's, which is basically a game loss, a truly scummy, cheaty thing to do. And because there's a manifest on the board, you're able to shuffle stuff around and made it seem like it was a completely legal play. It leaves the door open for all kinds of potential for.
Okay. So, I mean, that's true. I know people at home are screaming, oh, but if people are going to cheat, you can't stop them from cheating anyways. Well, the other point is it's just so complicated. Like I said, most people don't have the tokens. They don't have the overlays. So like, it becomes complicated to remember, did I morph this card or is it a manifested card? You have to keep them separate. It's just a lot of complexity.
Yeah, it's too much complexity. I think it's just leaves the potential for too much bad to happen, and this is really bad to have it in the same set. But besides that, I think it's a cool mechanic, so, you know, I'm not a judge, so I could care give a rat's ass now, I guess, at this point.
There's a common called Ethereal Ambush. 3 colorless, a blue and a green, and said manifest the top 2 cards of your library. It has 5 lines of rule text on a common.
New World Order!
I mean, right? Like, not only are the rares freaking like everything has a paragraph in this set, has multiple paragraphs. Their flagship common mechanic has 5 lines of rule text. And the next one, Dash, has 4 lines. Although it's a lot easier to understand in practice than Manifest.
Well, once you play Manifest the first time, then you'll figure it out. And it's not that hard once it's going.
Just.
Yeah, it is sad that they're like, their Planeswalker that they're promoting the set with, Ugin, has less text than some of the commons.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, your New World Order is getting blown out the window here. And like, man, the rares just, there's so many things. There's so many lines of text on these cards.
I must say, and this also complicates the entire procedure, but the choose one mechanic, I really like a lot. I think that's awesome. And I think that the more cards you print with things like choose one, and you make them those like two situationally good cards, the more skilled play you will see.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. I completely agree.
And that's an easy implementation, right? Like, that's not that complicated, or maybe it is, whatever, but it's really easy to grasp, and it's really easy to represent. Manifest just has so much rule text behind it. Like, you have to understand Morph in the first place, and that's something that a lot of people get wrong, or they don't reveal all their stuff, or it's just a lot of complexity, and I think that that's a complaint that many people have had about the set, and I agree entirely. What do you guys think about Dash, the other new mechanic, where it's basically the Archwing Dragon, where if you attack with it, it returns to your hand. You can play it for its dash cost. It has haste. Return to your hand at the end of the turn. What do you guys think about that mechanic?
I like that it's optional, because it was not optional with Archwing Dragon.
Right.
I was going to say, I'm excited to see what they can do with, like, the two we have now are nothing, like, particularly fantastic. The one that copies a creature is pretty cool, I guess, but, I mean, they could print a 1-mana one that's like a 3/2 or something like that. That could be relevant. I mean, it's one of those mechanics where like the door is open for them to do something busted with it. Whether or not they will is to be seen.
It's also it's a way to not overcommit to the board against sweepers while also attacking. Really nice tool for aggro decks against control.
Yep.
Or any deck against control.
Very interesting. Definitely allows you to apply pressure in a very effective way if you need to get that in.
I also like it because unlike Manifest, it's very simple to understand.
Yeah, surprisingly for as much text as there.
Like when the dash cost is cheaper than the converted mana cost also, which we haven't seen on every card they've spoiled.
Oh yeah, but I think the Storm Fury, the reason, I mean, a dash in at 5 and it comes in and attacks for 5 is pretty sweet. It's like a, it's not going to be nearly as good as one of the dragons that we just had recently. Oh, whatever. Speaking of Manifest, I want to talk about my pick of the week before you guys snipe it.
Pick of the week, pick of the week, pick of the week. Time for the pick of the week.
No, you're going to do this. I can't get sniped 2 weeks in a row.
Well, you're not going to get sniped. I'm going to say Ghostfire Blade.
Oh, good.
And maybe Trail of Mystery.
Like, I was gonna say Trail of Mystery, Dick.
Okay, well, I'll go with Ghostfire Blade. You got Trail of Mystery. But yeah. I mean, Ghostfire Blade is really cheap with all these Manifest creatures on the board. You get some really big creatures. Trail of Mystery also is gonna work really good, so.
I don't think it's gonna work really well, but I don't think it has to go up in price.
Yeah, you have a potential to get, like, major value and grind out stuff. But then again, I don't know. Like, having these cards in your deck is just, I don't know. I'm not sold on it, but it's bulk. So, like, yeah, the option to buy in and spend a few dollars to get a few cards just to see some gain is there. So, on Moto, they're 5 cents, and paper, they're 50 cents. If you spend a dollar in Moto and get 20 copies, I don't think it'll be a bad move for you whatsoever.
The only thing I was thinking about with Trail of Mystery, specifically, it's like, man, you got all these crap cards in your deck that don't really do anything. But if you have enough Manifest, like, hitting those extra Trail of Mysteries isn't actually that bad because you got the chance to turn it into a 2/2. That if it dies, you just lost an enchantment you didn't really want.
Plus, it
thins your deck out a ton.
You think it's like, you really think the like morphing guy's plan is fast enough for constructed?
No.
I think it's mid-rangey. I think it's going to be grindy enough because I saw the Silverwood Elemental. I'm going to keep calling it that forever. I saw Whisperwood Elemental and I was like, this could be this set's Huntmaster of the Fells. Or, you know, maybe if not Huntmaster, maybe Master of the Wild Hunt. because just you're farting out two twos. But these are two twos with upside, because every once in a while you're going to hit a creature that you can flip up more style. So I'm kind of bullish on it. I like how Trail of Mystery is going to thin your deck out and potentially be pretty explosive if you're flipping over a real creature. And I think the downside of having a somewhat dirtly card in your deck is mitigated slightly by the fact that Manifest can make it to a creature sometimes.
So what
otherwise
are you...
I wouldn't be really bullish on having an enchantment that I don't always want to draw on the deck. But I think Manifest specifically makes that a little better.
Are there enough morphs that like can compete with someone just going Caryatid, Rhino, Planeswalker?
I can't imagine. Yeah. I can't imagine that there won't be more morph stuff coming.
Yeah.
Well, if we're getting this Manifest, there's going to be more morph stuff. And if there isn't, then like we reevaluate.
And even so, there could be a casual deck, the kitchen, you know, kitchen table.
That's not going to move your Trail of Mystery or
I don't know. Trail of Mystery is going to go up based on speculation. You have to do this quickly. I think, irrespective of its playability, people are going to speculate on it.
It's literally bulk. It's literally bulk right now. Like the opportunity to play that is like you have just a potential high upside. If you're looking for cheap bulk picks, these have the potential to do something if something happens more than anything else.
That's a good point. I just keep in mind, what was the card from Theros that everyone did the same thing with on a?
Oh, Monobloom?
Yep.
And some people lost a lot of money out there. Halavish, I believe, did.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't think it was an absolute bulk, was it?
Well, that's why you don't get your finance advice from YouTube.
There was never a window to make money on Mana Bloom.
Yeah.
It went from 50 cents to like 75 cents.
They spoiled, the Eidolon way too early. If they'd spoiled it later, there would have been some time for the hype to build. But like as soon as everybody thought of Mana Bloom, it was already too late. They'd already spoiled Eidolon of Blossom.
I mean, I personally view Trail of Mystery in the same vein. Like, I mean, some people played Mana Bloom too, but there was never a chance to make money off of it.
That's fair.
But you're right. It's bulk, so it's hard to truly lose much. You know,
I think it goes up on speculation, and it's not one card that it hinges on the way Eidolon of Blossoms. I definitely saw the parallel when I was thinking about this for my pick of the week, but.
Yeah, there's a lot, so there is potential for this to fall flat on his face, but at the same time, there's potential for it to do well. So yeah, there. If you're a risk taker, go for it. If not, you know.
There's still more stuff coming in the third set also.
Yeah, so just stay with Corbin's pick of the week. Corbin, what is your pick of the week?
My pick of the week is a casual / commander card that, I talked a little bit about on Twitter for those of you who are following me there. Guiltleaf Archdruid. It's a rare from Morningtide. It costs 5 mana.
You didn't just talk about this on Twitter. Let's be honest. You wrote an Empeopled article. Then you used that Empeopled article to count as one of your QS Freeside daily posts. Then you talked about it on Twitter. Then you talked about it more on Reddit. So just to be clear, you haven't stopped talking about Guiltleaf Archdruid for like 72 hours.
72 hours.
72 hours.
We're recording this less than 24 hours after I wrote an article.
72 hours.
Anyways, it's actually a card that we've been tracking and I've been talking about following on QS for a little while, a couple weeks. It's a 5-mana druid that at 3/3, whenever you play a druid, you get a draw card. And when you can tap 7 untapped druids you control to gain control of all lands target player controls. I've been watching the card slowly rise. It's gone from basically a dollar a year ago to kind of like $1.75 right now. And there are not a ton of copies out on the market. You know, we've seen cards from Morningtide get expensive. Obviously the competitive cards from there can be ridiculously expensive, like a Vidillion Click, or, you know, kind of to a lesser extent with some of the others, 10 to 20. But even some of the casual cards in this set, have got expensive. Like Shared Animosity is $6. Idyllic Tutor is $15. Leaf Crown Elder randomly $3.50. Door of Destiny's Preeminent Captains were both 6 or 7. I'm pretty sure that the Druid has a lot of upside because of basically this run started with the new green mono green commander deck, because the Frey Elise, I believe is how you say it, the Planeswalker, the plus ability on it that makes Land of War Elves, they make Druids. So, and a lot of some of the other random like staple green cards just are druids naturally. So it's not, it's a, if you're playing with that commander, playing with Gilly Fartshu, it starts to become very attractive. And, you know, gaining control of all of somebody's lands is just a really splashy, fun ability. It's a lot more fun than Land Destruction, for instance. So there's just been a lot of momentum on the card. So I'm pretty sure that you'll see this go from $1.50 to $4 or $5 over the next several months.
Yeah, that's the sound of none of us disagreeing with you.
Ryan, what is your pick of the week?
I haven't paid attention to anything outside of a couple of spoilers this week. Sorry. Family. Spend time with your family. That's my pick of the week.
Oh, don't be a fucking asshole. We all spend time with our family. What are you doing?
Jason has busted everybody's balls on pick of the week.
No doubt. I'm sorry. Like, you don't want me to talk about Blue Air Heroic, so I'm not going to.
Yeah, because you've already fucking, you only get 75 picks of the week out of that deck. It's a dry hole now.
Man, Jason.
I haven't made any picks of the week out of that deck, actually. And you keep thinking, like, you've heard a lot about the deck, but I've not actually talked about it.
Right, you've written about it several times.
That's part of my series, but outside of that, no, I haven't. No, it's like literally in my series, that's what I'm doing, is I was picking a deck, and Blue Heroic is the deck I settled on.
I understand.
So, I mean, I understand you guys are sick of hearing about it, so I won't talk about it.
Hey, the deck's good, and you were on it pretty early, I give you that.
I mean, the deck is, it favors a format where your opponent is not trying to do anything to interact with you until turn three, which is the way this format is, and at that point they're only doing one thing a turn. So far I haven't seen anything in the spoiler that leads me to believe that format is going to change heavily. So, I mean, it looks good for Blue Eye Heroic. But
so
outside
we talked
of that, it's not much.
We talked a little bit about Valorous Stance, right? The two mana instant white, choose one, target creature's indestructible, or destroy target creature with toughness 4 or greater. So you can both protect your guy or kill a Siege Reiner or whatever.
Yeah.
So Ryan's pick of the week is Blue White Heroic is still good.
No, I mean, like, I haven't done anything in Magic Finance this week. I've been out with my family and stuff, and I tend to kind of disconnect because I don't really have any Magic friends back home. So when I go out there, I just don't really think about Magic, and I've looked
at spoilers. All I just hear is the sound of you being super unprofessional.
I mean,
oh
that's,
my God.
That's not super unprofessional. It's called
a
holiday.
Let the man spend time with his family.
Magic Finance, unlike for you guys, is my full-time job. So yeah, I get a vacation. So you want to talk about professional, there you go.
I'm in support of this because there's times I'll look at the pick of the week and like I am not going to just pull a pick of the week out of my ass just to fulfill the requirement. That's like not, that's lazy right there, I think. Sometimes you just don't have a pick of the week, you know?
My pick of the week is go buy 100,000 cards at a time. There you go.
That's solid advice, really. Anyways.
I would be fine only doing a pick of the week when I had a good one that I believed in and would actually spend my own money on, but that's not what our listeners want from us, man.
Right. That's understandable,
give them something to think about.
I'm also not going to give them bad advice.
It's fine.
Hold up, let's get feedback from our listeners. You guys let us know. Is Ryan being lazy or is Jason just being a prick?
Or
can it be both?
Both is acceptable.
It can be both.
No, I'll fully admit that I'm being lazy, but like I said,
hey man, if you don't have a good pick, I would rather you have no pick than give a bad pick.
Yeah. Standard is too stagnated
since
for me.
When?
To anything, like moving
since
around
when
there.
Is that the rule? Don't do a pick of the week if you don't have a good one.
We've
since I value it, our integrity.
Yeah,
oh,
well, not only that, but we've done this before. We've completely skipped pick of the week because multiple.
That's yeah,
true.
The four of us.
Oh my gosh! Decided. The rage, the salt, Jason.
Oh,
come on!
I don't even like you guys anymore.
Oh my god!
Go record your other podcast.
A draft.
Yeah, get out of here.
I wish I could record that twice a week.
I know.
Nobody's stopping you.
And this one, zero.
Yeah, we could end it right now, Jason. Just get out of here. Bye. So this is the end of the podcast. Next week we'll have a replacement for Jason E. Ault. So if anyone wants to, you know, apply for the position, please send us a 5-minute clip of your funniest shit that you got.
Brainstorm Brewery, the podcast where you don't get fired for not doing your fucking job. You get fired for pointing out that somebody else didn't.
Sounds correct.
That's how it rolls. Shit goes downhill.
That's the podcast everyone wants to be on.
Oh, and then shout out to everyone that bought our t-shirt.
No,
shut up.
No, wait, this is an acceptable shout out. I had the same reaction. This shout out seems okay.
Yeah, shout out to everyone that bought a t-shirt, supported the Teespring. Yeah, I'm glad you guys rock. The hoodies are cool.
The hoodies are sweet.
Yeah, I'm glad we gave myself 0.5 seconds to before we yelled at him about the shout out. And then we're like, oh, okay, never mind. That's fine. You've come up with one that's reasonable. I accept this.
I feel like I misplayed by not getting green. I got the black hoodie and I wish I'd got a green one too.
You didn't already have a black hoodie?
Yeah.
I didn't have a black hoodie.
I just got a t-shirt. Yeah.
Yeah, same here.
I've gotten a t-shirt and a hoodie every time we've offered both, but like that's all I wear because I like having awkward conversations with strangers about where our brewery's located.
Yeah, I'll wear it anywhere that isn't work. It seems a little awkward to wear to work, but because
Wait. I got a pick of the week.
What?
I got a pick of the week. My pick of the week is Chromanticore because the card's still cheap. It's so flared it pisses Jason off. Boom. There. You
I will
want
drive
you got
back
one.
To your house and I will shit in you.
Although we got a new card.
Come on. What's a new what?
There's a new card, but it's in Japanese.
Well, that's really helpful. Thanks, Marcel.
Well, it costs one colorless and two white.
Yeah, and by Friday, everyone will know what it is, and then we're going to sound like rubes.
Okay, no. We know what it does. When Lightform enters the battlefield, it becomes an aura with enchant creature. Manifest the top card of your library and attach it to it. Enchanted creature has flying and lifelink. It costs 3 mana.
Rageform is a cycle.
Yeah, this is an uncommon. You're gonna have for 3 mana, you can get a 2/2 flying lifelink that could also randomly turn into a morph creature with flying.
So you get a 2/2 double strike on Rageform, you get a 2/2 flying lifelink on this guy.
Seems pretty good in limited, honestly.
Yeah.
Worldly Tutor, that's my pick of the week. It's a 2/2 tutor.
Give it up.
And it works fantastic with Manifest. It really does. Congregation at Dawn. There's another one for you. You want me to keep going? I got these for days.
Yes.
These are poor.
They're not. No, actually, Worldly Tutor is like a really cheap tutor, and the rest of them have like crept up over the years. Worldly Tutor still stays really
worldly
cheap.
Worldly Tutor's really good in a lot of EDH decks that like Maelstrom Wanderer and Mael and stuff like that,
it's
too.
It's good at Mael. It's up 25% over the past year.
Fair.
It's like, but, it's like 550.
And that's
right
on
now.
Two oh, okay. printings? Three printings?
It's on two printings.
Two.
Mirage and six edition, yeah.
There hasn't even been a promo or anything of it, so. Yeah, so I mean, that one's fine. But I mean, with Manifest, you know, there's some pretty dirtily things you can do. I'm not saying that like you should go out and buy every hunted creature that exists or anything like that, because I don't think it's good. But like, there are cute little interactions that work well with Manifest. Like, anything that it's CMC is very low, but has like a really awful comes into play ability, like Phyrexian Dreadnought is fine with Manifest.
You know what Manifest sounds like? It sounds like a terrible magic themed party.
What?
Yeah, kind of.
Manifest.
You should put Manifest in your Spanish Inquisition. You can make your Spanish Inquisition Manifest Destiny deck.
Why would you do that? That doesn't even make sense, Marcel.
It certainly doesn't make sense.
I'm just spewing bullshit
Isn't Guiltleaf Archdruid the one where you tap 5 druids to steal all their lands?
It's 7. Did you listen to literally anything?
No, I space out.
Yeah, I did
that's
too.
The card that does that, because that's the Manifest Destiny Druid. So, thematically, we're bringing it around. The episode's going to be called Manifest Destiny, but it's going to be Manifest the way I punned it.
No, it's going to be the way Marcel tries to spell Manifest Destiny. I'm excited about this. Or, like, pronounce it.
He would say Manifest Density.
That's right. I did the first time. How'd you know?
As a chemist, I approve of this.
We're learning Marcel.
Hey, man.
You get your own language. It's fine.
I've been doing this my entire life. My brother made fun of me about the way I talked about magic cards, and it's continuing here. So, hey, at least I'm consistent. That's all that matters.
At least you had a pick of the week.
Hey, I came up with like 5 of them by the end. I had more than you did.
I could fart some out too.
Well, I mean, that's what you wanted from me. There you go. I mean, they're fine picks. Like, I don't think any of them are wrong. I think Manifest is one of those mechanics, and it's very cool in the sense where it's got people thinking, because there are some really sweet interactions throughout Magic. Manifest is one of those mechanics where, like, it does something inherently against the rules of Magic, and anytime you do that, you're going to come up with very cool things that can happen. Very corner cases, EDH cubable things that, like, you wouldn't see in normal games of Magic. And so, like, I support those things. I just don't like Manifest as, like, what it does for the headache. So, yeah. We'll see where it goes. Who knows, maybe like...
This is gonna be, I bet it'll be figured out by the time people are playing real limited events with this stuff. Yeah. I bet it's going to be a real headache at your pre-release, with your rules advisor being the official. So, I don't know. Enjoyed this headache at the pre-release, I guess. But I still think it's a cool mechanic and it's worth the headache.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I'm not really mad about it. It's just, it's annoying that, it takes something so complicated because of how complicated magic is itself to make something that could be so simple, you know? It's just, I mean, we all know what it is by this point.
We can be found on GatheringMagic.com and BrainstormBrewery.com.